Religious tension in India, not new.
Jai Shri Ram, long live the god Ram. And now there goes another tear gas canister. And now he's got one off, there he's got another one off. But there are still crowds, few people, standing in this narrow alley here, shouting, long live Shri Ram.
Veteran BBC correspondent Mark Tully, who you hear there, has been covering unrest in South Asia since the 1960s. Having witnessed at least three wars and persistent religious violence, Tully has seen it all in India. Stepping back from Mumbai, taking the long view with Sir Mark Tully, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 5th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora. You know, Mark Tully is like having Rudyard Kipling on the program.
Yeah, he's extraordinary. Decades and decades of insight on Southeast Asia. We're going to hear from him. Also, we're going to talk about the automakers on Capitol Hill, the latest from crisis-ridden Zimbabwe. Problems now include a cholera outbreak, and we have some sports, football, basketball, and plane tickets. All in the same story. We'll explain that. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
The big three auto CEOs are in Washington today, hoping to avoid capital punishment.
We're looking at a death sentence here if we don't respond intelligently and prudently.
Banking Committee Chair Chief Senator Chris Dodd, many lawmakers are skeptical of an auto bailout, though the CEOs say they can turn things around and eventually pay back any multi-billion dollar loans they receive. Here's Ford Chief Alan Mulally.
It used to be that we focused heavily on trucks and SUVs. Now we are shifting to a balanced product portfolio with even more focus on small cars and the advanced technologies that will drive higher fuel economy in all of our vehicles.
Latest wrinkle from Congress is that some legislators representing automaking states are threatening to hold hostage the rest of the $700 billion bailout package unless the White House releases money for car makers.
A big part of the auto company's pitch is that if they fail, it will trigger massive job losses. We'll get a better sense of the national employment picture later this hour when the new numbers are released. The newest monthly unemployment numbers, they come out today. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and African leaders are cranking up the pressure on Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe. Rice said it is, quote, well past time for Mugabe to leave office. This, as Kenya's prime minister says, African nations should come together to throw out Mugabe, an unusual call from one head of state to ouster another head of state.
The Dow dropped 2.5% yesterday, closed at 83.76. The S&P lost nearly 3%, ending at 845. Oil prices are around $44 a barrel in the bargain basement. Then Wall Street is poised to open flat this morning, waiting for those unemployment figures. So all the little economic indicators out there in our radio listening audience, 877-8-MY-TAKE, get on the horn. Are you part of the underemployed? Are you part of this nation of part-timers that we've been profiling all week? All week we've been looking at the changing labor force in our series on underemployment. But on unemployment stat day, we want to hear if you were laid off, how you were told, all right? How did it go? How was that meeting? Was there any eye contact? Was it a text message? Did somebody just need to move in a different direction? Was it not clicking? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I think it's not really working. I think we're going to move in a different direction.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So another day on Capitol Hill for the automakers' executives, and another day of tortured metaphors as lawmakers attempt to nail down, there it goes again, some kind of a bailout bridge loan program to save the auto industry. And the demeanor of the CEOs was much different than it was 2 weeks ago. Yesterday it was the Senate, where they talked about some specific details of a plan to bail out the car makers with loans or even something called a prepackaged bankruptcy. They were getting down to brass tacks, which Todd Zwillick will be thrilled to know is my beginning to conversation with him. Todd, you were there for all the Senate hearings wall to wall, right?
Yes, I was.
And let's talk about the brass tacks to begin with. Here's Robert Nardelli, the chairman and CEO of Chrysler, talking about what Christopher Dodd also referred to repeatedly yesterday, that the TARP, the Federal Treasury, needs to be opened to at least allow some money to help these car makers make it into the first quarter of next year. Here's Nardelli.
I also want to reinforce the need for Chrysler Financial to receive immediate assistance from TARP, as their continued vitality is a critical assumption in our plan.
Todd, it sounds like Nardelli is making the case to the Senate that part of the auto companies are actually banks, and they should be helped like banks.
Yeah, that's correct, John. And you're seeing a wrinkle in the strategy, a new strategy this week from what you saw a couple of weeks ago when the Big Three's visit to Capitol Hill was an unmitigated failure. Yes, they're making the case that the financing arms, those are the arms of the car companies that give you your financing when you buy a car. They're actually
technically
separate companies. They also
finance the dealers. They finance the dealers'
Correct.
Inventory, too. It's interesting.
Correct. So they want access to the TARP, and up until now, of course, the administration has refused. They've said that TARP money is for protection of the integrity of the financial services industry and the financial services backbone of the economy. Well, you're seeing the case being made now that if GM and Chrysler especially fail, it stands a good chance of dragging down the financial sector with it. They not mm-hmm. only made the case for the financing arms, but there was also part of their reports, part of their plans, and also an analysis from JP Morgan saying that if GM and Chrysler go down in short order, it would expose the financial sector to something close to $2 trillion in exposure. So they are clearly making the case that, yes, Treasury, if protecting the financial services sector is the imperative of the TARP, this is all about that.
That's a great takeaway. So connecting themselves to the financial crisis and also saying, hey, we're part of the financial system with our financing arms. Now,
that's right.
Explain the details of this so-called prepackaged bankruptcy plan that Senator Corker was pushing so hard in the hearings yesterday. It's basically an agreement to meet some targets, and if you don't meet the targets, then you have to declare bankruptcy. How's that going to work?
Well, it's very unclear how it would work. It's unclear how any there are six or eight ideas out there, and they're all half-baked. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. It means everybody's throwing out, you know, the skeletons and grains of their ideas into the mix, and they're all kind of getting mixed around. And we won't know until well into the weekend or after the weekend which of these approaches is going to bubble up.
Well, in the tortured metaphor zone, then, I guess half-baked lame duck, is that an entree? Is that a lunch dish? Or is that a sandwich? Let's end on the sense of desperation. I won't force you to go there, Todd. Let's end on
I had
the sense
a good
of,
one, but that's okay.
let's end on the sense of desperation from Rick Wagoner. Here he is really just sort of saying, come on, save us.
We obviously have a lot of things that we're proud of. There's a lot of great accomplishments on the company's behalf, and there are also mistakes during our history. What we're trying to do is we put this plan together, which we submitted earlier this week, was to learn from both of those, learn from our contributions, our successes, and learn from our mistakes.
So there you got it, Todd. Lame duck, half-baked humble pie.
Well, again, this
is that going to work?
This is the other part of the change strategy, which is if they want their money this week, not in January, not mm-hmm. in February, now. And to do that, I'm sorry, you have to make yourself appear as pathetic as possible, because if Congress doesn't come to your rescue, the case is we're dead. We're dead. You got to do it now.
I mean, there is half baked, as John said. Apologies there. But it's also interesting what Senator John Tester, Democrat of Montana, said, which is the car makers are really having to go through something that the financial industry didn't when they got their checks.
Well, they're having to, that's true. They're having to go out in front of the public, and the financial services industry also doesn't have a place in the culture that the car makers do as the backbone of American manufacturing, which is an emotional issue and a culturally relevant issue, and that's part of their identity that you see the lawmakers from the manufacturing states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and others coming out and making that this is not only essential to the economy and essential to jobs, it's essential to our identity, and the financial services guys did not have to go through that.
It's just amazing how little that is helping them, being connected to the culture. Well, Todd Zwillick, it's the House today, and we will talk to you next week to see where this stands. But Todd Zwillick, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
My pleasure.
go, 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 Dobbs Willick.
We're going to stay with the Senate this week. The Georgia Senate race finally came to an end, but the recount drags on in Minnesota between Republican incumbent Norm Coleman and Democratic challenger Al Franken. The recount was supposed to wrap up today, but now 130 lost ballots in Minneapolis may push it into next week. Joining us now is Tom Scheck, a reporter at Minnesota Public Radio, for the latest. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, guys.
So what happened with the lost ballots?
Well, I think it's just another reason why we think this Senate race is never going to end. When they went through and they were recounting all these votes, which they're doing all over the state, and they're almost wrapping up, on Wednesday, they couldn't find the Minneapolis officials couldn't find an envelope in one precinct, and it had 130 missing ballots in it, and basically Al Franken had the 36-vote advantage in that envelope, in that batch of votes. And on Wednesday, they said, you know what, we think what actually happened is some of the ballots got kicked out because there were write-ins through the machine, and the folks reprocessed those ballots, and it was just a double count. So we're not going to count this. Well, the Franken campaign looked at that and said, that doesn't square with the number of voters who signed in at the polling place, and we think you guys made a mistake, and we think these ballots are missing. Well, the elections director went back, took a look at all the numbers, and said, you're right. We can't find these ballots. There's a missing envelope of 130, and so they basically are looking for them, and they can't find them. She thinks that they're in the elections warehouse, this massive elections warehouse in Minneapolis.
She thinks, Tom, and they're going
that's what she says. She thinks they're there. They actually are. The Franken campaign is also saying, you know what, go back and look at, it's Minnesota, so it's naturally a Lutheran church where the polling place was that night, and take a look there, too. That led to another criticism by the Norm Coleman campaign to say that the Al Franken campaign is trying to do a taxpayer-funded investigation of a religious institution. So this is just how heightened the senses are here.
I mean, it's an extraordinary story, an extraordinarily close race. I mean, what's the feeling there in Minnesota? Do people have any faith that this is a credible system?
Yes, they do. I mean, Minnesotans always pride themselves on the fact that, okay, we're running clean elections, everything's going to go fine. But it is a little bit frustrating because earlier in the week in Ramsey County, where St. Paul is based, they found 171 ballots in a voting machine that never got processed. That voting machine broke down. The folks never took the ballots out and reprocessed them. That gave Al Franken a 37-vote advantage. So on Tuesday, Franken picked up 37 votes. On Wednesday, he loses 36 votes. So it's kind of one of those things where everyone's like, what's going on here?
I'm kind of liking it, though. I actually think it's kind of fun. I mean, the idea of somebody's going to have to go into the Lutheran church there and look for an envelope. It's got about 130 ballots in it there, you know, and just bring it out.
Yeah, but the problem with all of this, Tom, is that it's very serious. So the 130 lost ballots, what is the count right now? And then what are the challenges that each side has made to the count? And do you have any sense at all when this is going to be final?
Well, it's going to be final when the canvassing board decides it's final. And that's probably going to be right before Christmas. At this point, they have about 98.88% of the ballots counted. What they're going to be doing is they're going to be finishing up at most of these counties, and they're going to leave that Minneapolis election, that Minneapolis precinct, open while they look for those ballots. At this point, when you take it varies in terms of who's ahead. Everyone kind of thinks Norm Coleman's still ahead, between 205 to 250 votes.
Mm-hmm.
But there are all of these challenges. There's 6,500 challenges that the canvassing board has to go through. Now, both campaigns said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to start withdrawing those challenges in the week before the canvassing board meets.
So, in other words, it's not close to the end. Tom Scheck, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, thanks very much.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So unemployment numbers out in just a few minutes. And as a nation of part-timers, or if you add the part-timers to the unemployed, it's like 12% of the workforce. We want to know how you got laid off or how you lost your full-time job. Tell us your best story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
We're going to talk about Zimbabwe now. As the governing crisis continues there, there are also now growing concerns about food availability. And in addition to that, Zimbabwe is suffering through a cholera epidemic that's killed nearly 600 people and is spreading across the border, according to some. An unnamed South African official is quoted as saying, President Robert Mugabe has lost control of Zimbabwe and the country could implode. Martin Plaut is the BBC's Africa editor. We spoke with him earlier, and I asked him about the strong word that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had for Robert Mugabe today.
She's talking in Copenhagen. It's part of her farewell tour. And she said that it's well past time for Robert Mugabe to leave. She could describe the elections that were held in which he was elected as a sham, and saying that many African countries have spoken out about the need for change in Zimbabwe, but many others have been silent, and now is the time to speak. So, you know, there is certainly pressure coming from her.
But there's been tremendous pressure for months, including pressure from South Africa for Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai, his opposition, the leader of the opposition party, to resolve their differences and move forward. Where are they in that process?
Well, it's sort of in limbo land. Nothing is really happening. The opposition, the MDC, has refused to accept what is essentially a junior position in the government. They said, we'll not just sort of be window dressing for the government. They want the Home Affairs Ministry, which is critical. They said that the Defense Ministry can remain with Robert Mugabe, but they want the Home Affairs Ministry, which, apart from anything else, would oversee the next election. So that they want that. It also oversees the police that they say are critical in stopping the violence that's gone on against their members. So that is what their demand is. Mugabe's not prepared to give in to it, so there is just a standoff.
And meanwhile, there is this looming humanitarian crisis and now a cholera outbreak. Tell us the latest on those two fronts.
Well, I was just speaking to a United Nations official, and as you said in the cue to this piece, about 600 people have died. In fact, that's probably way, way under the accurate figure. What we know is that 600 people have been registered at clinics that are open who have died of cholera. The figure is possibly twice or maybe even three times that figure of the actual death toll, because a lot of people are not going to clinics. They're just dying in the rural areas, and a lot of the clinics are now closed. The doctors and nurses have been on strike for a long time. They are hardly, their wages hardly pay for them to get to work. They have no drugs. They have nothing available. Meanwhile, the cholera epidemic is just extraordinary. For a long time, the water supply in Harare was cut off because they had no chemicals to purify it. There's raw sewage running through suburbs. It is just an appalling situation.
And so what can be done?
Well, a lot of aid agencies are flying in assistance now. For example, the Red Cross has announced that it has sent 13 tons of medical supplies to Harare International Airport. And, it's extraordinary the kind of things they have to distribute. They have, for example, just supplied sewerage rods to the Harare municipal authorities, to the capital authorities, so they can unblock drains, because that's one of the key issues. Now, you can imagine when you get to the point where you don't even have rods to unblock the sewerage system, just how bad the situation is. But in the longer term, these individual efforts by people like Oxfam, by the Red Cross, are not enough. You cannot feed 5 million people with these kind of efforts. You need a change of administration if this is going to be held. That is certainly what people are arguing.
But, Martin, you are describing this humanitarian crisis as being completely a consequence of a failed infrastructure, and that in that situation,
it's so difficult for humanitarian agencies to deal with it, because when the infrastructure fails, the scale immediately ramps up to 5 million.
Yeah, absolutely. That is certainly true. And, you know, it's going to take an enormous effort if we're not going to see, you know, tens of thousands of people dying, particularly in the rural areas where, you know, it's hard to reach. The other thing that's happened is that there's been an outbreak of anthrax, which is stripping people of their cattle. And worse than that, people are so hungry, some of them are even eating the carcasses of cattle that they think or probably know died of anthrax. Now, can you imagine the danger of feeding that to your child when that is the only way that you have of keeping them alive, but you know it'll probably infect them? It's just a catastrophic situation.
Is there any way for humanitarian agencies to bring in supplemental food supplies to get people off of the infected herds so that the livestock problem can be handled without infecting the people?
Yes, there are. I mean, you know, the government of Zimbabwe has now declared an emergency. They've become open about it. In the past, they said there wasn't an emergency. They could cope. But they're now saying, yes, there is an emergency. Please come and help. So that doorway is open. Mm-hmm. But as I say, you know, the individual efforts of individual agencies is hugely important, but not enough. You can't bring in food for 5 million people. Only something like the United Nations can shift that amount of food, and that really requires assistance from the international community. And the international community really is saying, listen, when you have a fair system of a political system, we will really come to your aid. But until then, we'll only provide token assistance. So the people of Zimbabwe are now sort of caught in a political limbo.
That's Martin Plaut with that sobering report on Zimbabwe. He is the BBC's Africa editor. Thanks, Martin. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines of the hour.
And the time is 28 minutes past the hour. Now, could you call it a coup in Canada? Well, Prime Minister Stephen Harper certainly hopes not. He suspended Parliament till the end of January, so his minority government won't be voted out of office. Opposition parties have strongly condemned the suspension. They say that they will try to remove Mr. Harper when Parliament reconvenes. Mexico say that they found 13 bodies in the northwestern part of Mexico, the area's home to one of the country's most violent drug cartels. Most of the victims were teenagers. This comes right after the U.S. announced that it's releasing $200 million to support Mexican police and soldiers in the fight against drug cartels, with more funds on the way. At least 4,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence in Mexico so far this year. The head of the Russian Orthodox Church died today at age 79. Patriarch Alexei II has led the church since 1990. He rose through the ranks quickly because he was a favorite of the KGB. But then he went on to make sure the church played a leading role in the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the church did not mention the cause of death, but the patriarch had some serious heart problems. And the credit crunch is driving Americans to the movies. That's according to the CEO of the largest theatre chain in the US. Mike Campbell from Regal Entertainment Group says that his chain is having a really good quarter and box office revenue has doubled. If you're heading to the movies today, you can see Cadillac Records starring Beyonce and Adrian Brody, and also Frost Nixon starring Michael Sheen and Frank Langella.
Thanks for that, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Just out, the Department of Labor is telling us that last month, well over a 500,000 people joined the ranks of the unemployed. The jobless rate has risen to 6.7%. It was the most jobs cut since 1974. That's 533,000 people had a meeting like this.
I was over 50, and most of the other people I was working with, except for my boss, were in their 20s and 30s. I did the work of three people, so I was told that things just weren't clicking.
And
apparently a 500,000 others were told things weren't clicking. Tell us your worst or best reduced hours story, or tell us how you got laid off at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We've been looking at underemployment and unemployment all week long. Joining us now is David Cherson from Boston, Massachusetts. David, you had a meeting like that, didn't you, when you were working for a software company?
A few meetings.
Can you recall one story of when you were told that your job was ending?
Well, I was one of the many people who left Digital Equipment Corporation, or I used to say it left us, and it was kind of like a rolling thunder. You know, there were different groups that were getting hit at different times, and it took a few years, but it finally hit hit my group, and you know, I was on a list. I had just come back, and in fact, just won an award, as a matter of fact, and came back from a business trip or in Hong Kong, and I was on the list
to be laid off.
Yeah,
and then of course the company went away. I mean, it's different when the company goes away, I suppose. But you know, in this job environment, and you've now been a temp worker, basically, knitting together a career that's made up of very different kinds of jobs for 2.5 years now, right?
More or less. I've tried to keep it, within the sphere of my expertise, so to speak, and that's very important. People should realize for your little piece of paper called a resume.
Well, let's look at your resume a little bit. All week long, we've been asking people to deliver their sort of slash resume to us, radio host slash musician slash daddy, all the things that constitute your sort of value to the world in some sense. How many slashes do you have?
I keep to a minimum, John. Other than that, you look like too much of a jack of all trades. Let's see, project manager.
Slash.
Consultant.
Slash.
Sales operations manager.
Slash. Ooh, that's a few. But have you managed to dip into house painter or telemarketer?
Don't go to telemarketing. It's kind of like a category by itself, and it's the hardest of the hard.
And you've done it.
I did it once, and I will try not to do it again.
Well, what's it like psychologically when you realize that the job that you were great at, there's not a company that is hiring in that department, and you have to really dig within yourself and find other skills that are going to be saleable, especially when there's the pressure of a family?
Yeah, I always refer to, I've been through a few periods of un and underemployment, and I always refer to that dull ache one feels. And I'm sure a lot of people out there will empathize with that. But what's very important for individuals is that you retain your sense of what I call legitimacy. You feel that you're still viable, and you really have skills and a background that you still can contribute. And you don't have to end up, being a cab driver, or which I've done much in another phase of my life, but not recently. And, something that still you can contribute and at least have one skill that you've utilized in your career and it can keep going.
Well, I guess the sad thing of what you're saying there is everybody has a category of, all right, I'm not going to do this. At least I don't have to do this kind of thing. But how do you measure the sort of things that are beneath you? Well, while still keeping your sense of broadness open enough so that you can take advantage of opportunities as they come along. I mean, if you sell yourself too short, you're going to have fewer opportunities. If you're willing to do anything, you end up kind of in this jack of all trades humiliation that you describe. How do you find a balance?
It's like fighting a war on two fronts, if I may use the military analogy. There is a saying we have amongst us. Veteran tempers that, you got to do what you got to do. And, but at the same time, you want to keep a bigger perspective and, want to keep the big picture in mind that you still want to contribute. You want something that's within or your skills and background or maybe develop them further. So at the same time that you're trying to eke out a living, you've got to fight the war on the other front, for your career.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the 533,000 people who are joining you. Does it feel good that this happened to you 2.5 years ago because you wouldn't want to have to do it in the challenging environment now? Or Do you have some sort of universal advice for people entering this sphere right now?
First and foremost, stress management. Matter of fact, I just came back from my gym and my workout, which I do, you know, cardio and resistance and weight training. You know, not only for one's figure, so to speak, but for managing a stress, because it's a very, very stressful period to go through. And that would be one piece of advice. The other is that keep in mind that a resume in a job description or analogous, they're outlines. You know, I wish that we could burn our resumes and just go in for tryouts like we do in the major leagues. But of course, there's too many people, and companies couldn't deal with that. You know, because you really never know a person from their resume how they really are on the job. Maybe there's a hidden advantage to temping and contracting, that you actually get to go on a job and you know, without the preconditioning of all the interviewing, you know, that
and you get
to see your skills.
You get to some human-to-human contact, which, of course, is, you know, what is behind all of the economic numbers. David Cherson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
David Cherson, veteran temp, as he calls it, joined us from Boston, Massachusetts, one of the 12% of the American workforce underemployed or unemployed. And now Femi Okeh is here with some headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. A new economic report this morning. The Labour Department's reporting that the jobless rate for November rose to 6.7%. That means that more than 500,000 Americans lost their jobs last month. India's new top law enforcement official says that there have been, and I'm quoting here, lapses in the government's security system. He's working to improve it, and that announcement came amid a public uproar since terrorist attacks in Mumbai last week left more than 170 people dead. Armed robbers, some dressed in drag, have raided a Harry Winston jewelry store in Paris. Police believe they stole millions of dollars worth of gems. And scientists say that it will cost more than $20 million to repair damage to the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. That's the huge underground machine that they're using to recreate conditions that existed just after the Big Bang. They say that experiments will not begin again until the middle of next year. And baseball star Barry Bonds has fewer federal charges to worry about. Prosecutors dropped 4 counts of lying to a grand jury. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Much of what scientists know about how memory works is thanks to one man known only as H.M. And, John, you said it is an extraordinary story.
Well, he's the window biologists found on the brain that helped us to understand memory. H.M. is an amazing story. That is true.
He underwent an experimental surgery in the 1950s to cure his epilepsy. Parts of his brain were removed, and he lost his short-term memory. And until his death earlier this week, H.M. helped neuroscientists study how memory works. Joining us to explain more is Benedict Carey, human behavior and psychology reporter at the New York Times. Good morning, Benedict.
Good morning.
So explain to us how H.M. became so critical to the knowledge of scientists of our memory.
Well, as you said, he had this surgery, and back in the 1950s, they didn't understand so well what different regions of the brain, how they functioned. And so there was some uncertainty about what the outcome would be. He did have seizures, and they were severe. And so the neurosurgeon took a chance and took out a couple of areas in the brain that include a region called the hippocampus that often help epileptic patients when they're removed, at least when one is removed.
Mm-hmm. And what did they discover after they did that?
Well, they discovered that the patient, the seizures were gone or abated anyway. But the man, whose name is Henry Mollison, couldn't form new memories. That is, he did have short-term memory. He could hold a thought in his head for 20 seconds, perhaps longer if he concentrated,
up to
several minutes.
20 seconds.
Short-term memory. He had that. What he didn't have was the ability to convert that memory into a long-term one. And so the significance of that was that it showed scientists the region, the areas that are important for turning short-term memories into lasting long-term ones.
Let's listen to him being interviewed about this very issue of remembering what he had done even in a single day.
What do you do during a typical day?
See, that's what I don't remember things.
Uh-huh. Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
I don't even remember that.
As you said, Benedict, he couldn't convert those memories into long-term memory. What have scientists been able to do with the information that they learned from him?
Well, a couple things. One is the thing I just mentioned. It told them that these areas that were removed were critical for converting short-term to long-term memory. The other big thing was the study of HM showed that there were at least two independent memory systems. One is the one we all think of as memory, that is converting short-term to long-term memory. I remember your name, we remember mine, we remember what we had for breakfast. The other is called motor learning, which is what happens when we practice piano or ride a bike. And that's mostly subconscious or unconscious. We're not tracking it in the same way that we do or recording it in the same way we do when we're remembering words or names.
Ben I just remembered we have to go.
Okay.
I just remember we got to go. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Benedict Carey is a reporter for the New York Times, and he has a story about HM in the New York Times today.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 5th. Femi Okeh has joined us, and she has the headlines of the hour. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Grilled automakers are on Capitol Hill menu today. The big three CEOs face more tough questions on their pitch for tens of billions in loans from taxpayers. The House hearings start next hour. Several Blackwater military contractors could face 30 years in prison for a 2007 shooting in Iraq that killed local civilians. The guards say that they were threatened, but witnesses say that they were unprovoked. The Justice Department is preparing charges, which they may announce on Monday. With the new security pact in Iraq taking effect, American forces are shifting strategy. The top commander in Iraq says that troops will have new rules and all American operations will have to include Iraqi forces. The security deal says that US troops must be out by the end of 2011. The international airport in Thai capital of Bangkok has resumed full operations following an eight-day occupation by anti-government protesters. Up to 300,000 travellers were left stranded by the demonstrations, and while the situation is now returning to normal, not all of the airlines are operating a full service, as this traveller found out, unfortunately.
We were supposed to fly to Phuket this morning, but when we came to the airport in Stockholm, they told us the flight was going to Bangkok. So now we're waiting for a connecting flight to Phuket.
He sounds wary. The anti-government protesters that shut down the airports got their wish. The Prime Minister of Thailand will be stepping down. And finally, it's an open debate, but the newsroom's favourite Simpson is probably Lisa. But sometimes events warrant reporting on a far less popular member of the clan. That would be O.J. Simpson. The disgraced former football star learns today just how long he'll have to go to prison. Simpson was convicted on armed robbery and kidnapping charges in Nevada, and the judge has a very tough reputation. She could give him life in prison or as little as 6 years.
OJ goes to the big house. 3 years are mandatory, I understand. Thank you, fam.
You won't be hearing from me for a little while then.
That's right.
You're welcome.
Well, history repeats itself, we often observe. In South Asia, you might say, history since the partition of India and Pakistan has been in violent reruns, leading right up to the attacks last week in Mumbai.
Now the police are moving in to drive away these people. You hear the police whacking someone there. And here's a man being
beaten
up.
It's the voice of Sir Mark Tully, the former South Asia correspondent for the BBC, reporting not on the Mumbai attacks last week, but on interreligious violence that took place back in 1993. Mark Tully joined us from the BBC bureau in New Delhi earlier this morning, and I asked him if last week's attacks could be seen in a wider context.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think the one of the really crucial things about this is that we are seeing in India a resurgence of attempts to cause religious hatred between parties. And of course, when you get an incident like this, there is the real danger that that hatred will surge into violence and recriminations and revenge, as did happen, at the time of the Bombay blasts and indeed at the time of the pulling down of the mosque in Ayodhya. But at the same time, India also does have a long history of communal harmony. And we shouldn't just think of India as a country which is permanently on the boil, if I could put it like that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the religious tensions or communal record of peaceful coexistence in India between Muslims and Hindus. The minority is sizable, 100 million, upwards of 100 million Muslims in India. And there were numerous accusations from Pakistani officials that we talked to last week who said that India needs to do more to reduce the tension between Hindus and Muslims. Otherwise, these kinds of attacks will be easily able to exploit the tensions inside India. Do you go along with that?
Well, certainly, I do think that what is needed in this country is that the economic position of the Muslim community should be improved. And there was a report some years back which confirmed this. And I also think that educational opportunities for Muslims should be improved. And, of course, it's very, very important indeed that a community as large as the Muslims, one could say it's even perhaps as large as 150 million, perhaps, must feel absolutely a part of India. But it's a bit rich for Pakistan to say this because, of course, they have in the past done what they can to stir up tension between Hindus and Muslims. And I think I go back to that point, you know, that this is a country where a Muslim can worship absolutely freely. None of the sort of disputes we have in my home country, Britain, about whether people can wear burqas or whether you can hear the sound of the call to prayer or not, whether that's allowed. None of these sort of disputes exist. Muslims are absolutely free to live their life. And of course, there are many, many Muslims who live prosperous and happy lives. There is a lot to be done, but it's very important not to exaggerate that and not to give the impression, as I said, of continuous tension.
Well, give me a sense of the evolution since partition of people in India regarding their neighbor Pakistan. Has it gone from a sense of this is a neighboring rival country with some border disputes to being more in the rhetoric that I heard last week of being just a chaotic land where terrorists learn how to do what happened in Mumbai last week?
Yes, I think there has been a change in the attitude towards Pakistan in that respect. But first of all, one does have to say that from the beginning, sadly, this relationship was a very bad relationship. There have been moments, there were under Nehru, there was in the last government, there have been in this government, when there were some possibilities of an improvement, but those possibilities never matured. But and the other thing, of course, which is an abiding impression impression in India is that Pakistan is essentially run by the army, no matter who happens to actually apparently to be in power. And what goes with that is the impression in India, a senior official, Indian official was telling me this only today, that the Pakistan army wants to keep relationship with India bad because that justifies its existence. Yeah. As he put it to me, it's an existential problem. So I think that is the sort of basis of the relationship, and you're seeing that come up again. But of course, the problem has become that much more serious because of this evidence, which India says it has, of direct Pakistan involvement in attacks like the one we've just seen and in the attack on Parliament.
Well, Sir Mark, before we go, just very quickly, I mean, with all of your experience and with all that India has going for it economically that we've experienced over the last decade, and Pakistan too, for that matter, I don't hear you sounding terribly hopeful at this point.
I'm not hopeful about India-Pakistan relations. I'm afraid that once again we're just getting into that dreary rut of accusation and counter-accusation. I do believe that international pressure is going to be necessary to resolve this problem. And it's interesting that India, which in the past has always said it wants only to have a bilateral discussion about the Pakistan-India problems, is now calling for international pressure. But equally, I would say that India-Pakistan problems are not the whole of the life of either of those countries. And I believe that India could well be in a position to weather the present economic storm better than many countries. And I think India will continue to grow and to develop.
Sir Mark Tully with a hopeful message, former South Asia correspondent for the BBC. We thank him so much for being part of the program. And if you listen to the World Service for years, as I used to on shortwave, Mark Tully in Delhi.
Mark Tully joined us from Delhi. And you've enjoyed saying that several times this morning.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things, like Sylvia Pajoli, you know, it's like sticks in your mind. So are we becoming a nation of part-timers? All week we've been looking at the changing labor force. Tell us how you were told your hours were going to be reduced. Or were you let go altogether?
I was laid off and was called into a conference room. And given the bad news, the bitter irony of it was that we had just gotten our new business cards 2 days before. So I was left with 1,000 business cards. I've been cutting them up and using them to write notes to myself, so they're not going to waste, but I still have about 950 to go.
Ouch. Wow. Was there any eye contact in your layoff meeting? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And we're always on here at The Takeaway. Here's a takeaway.
They want their money this week, not in January, not in February, now. And to do that, I'm sorry, you have to make yourself appear as pathetic as possible, because if Congress doesn't come to your rescue, the case is we're dead. You got to do it now.
That's Todd Zwillick with Capital News Connection talking about the three heads of the automakers Capitol Hill.
Advice for people who want $34 billion now from Capitol Hill. Just look pathetic.
Look
I'm John Huckenberry.
Pathetic. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So, Jeffrey Morgenthaler from Eugene, Oregon, on the line from Washington, D.C. Get up, dude. This is your day.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're a bartender, right?
I am.
And there's a little bit of history that you'd like all Americans to remember about this day, right?
Yeah, a really dark time for the United States, the 13 years of prohibition from 1920 to 1933.
And that ended 75 years ago today?
75 years ago today.
And you want that to be a holiday?
I want it to be recognized as a day of celebration, for sure.
So what would you call this end of prohibition holiday?
We call this day Repeal Day.
So kind of deck the halls, it's Prohibition Repeal Day, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Is that the idea?
A beautiful song, yeah.
Is that the idea?
Exactly.
As if we all need another reason to drink Jeffrey Morgenthaler this time of year. It's the takeaway.
We need another reason to
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 5th, and boy, he sounded committed to repeal day.
We need another reason to drink this time of year, according to Jeffrey Morgenthaler. Good morning, Adora.
Today, the jobless numbers are out and the national unemployment rate has risen. We're going to have more on that story coming up. Also, we're going to talk about immigration policy and about sports. Coming up soon, those stories, but first headlines.
We have actually 533,000 new reasons to drink. Big ugly numbers just out this hour. Companies cut more than 500,000 jobs in November, the most in nearly 35 years, puts the national unemployment rate at 6.7%. Traders aren't liking the news at all. It looks like Wall Street is going to open down. And car makers say they need tens of billions of dollars in loans, more economic news, or else those jobless numbers could go much higher. Here's GM CEO Rick Wagoner.
There's a lot of great accomplishments on the company's behalf, and there are also mistakes during our history. What we're trying to do is we put this plan together, which we submitted earlier this week, was to learn from both of those, learn from our contributions, our successes, and learn from our mistakes.
All three CEOs are on the Hill today making their case. House hearings will start shortly. They're also pushing the Bush administration for help, but they've gotten a cool response so far. Here's White House Press Secretary Dana Perino.
It's a little too early to say. We just got the summaries of those plans yesterday, and officials here are poring over them as they are at the Treasury Department and the Commerce Department.
The big three hope for an assist from lawmakers in car-making states. Those legislators are threatening to hold back the rest of the $700 billion bailout package. They want the White House to release money for car makers.
So the Dow dropped 2.5% yesterday to close at 83.76. The S&P lost nearly 3%. And as we said, based on the unemployment figures, we're looking at a lower opening on Wall Street this morning. Oil prices are around $44 a barrel. There's a positive note. Are we becoming a nation of part-timers with all those new people added to the unemployment rolls? All week long, we've been looking at the changing labor force. Tell us how you were told it's over, how you got laid off. What was it, a meeting? Was it a text message? Was it an email? Tell us your worst at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Or your best. Perhaps it was handled well. We would like to hear that story, too. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Did they hold your hand? That would be nice. A little pillow, perhaps?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the economy. And while the Treasury and the Congress and banks around the world tweak with interest rates and $700 billion little drops in the bucket, the trend is well established in the recession. Just over a half an hour ago, the Labor Department released unemployment numbers for November. Employers slashed over 530,000 jobs in November. That catapults the unemployment rate to 6.7%. Dramatic proof that the recession is deepening, that the unemployment trend and the recession trend is well established. And for more on the numbers, we're joined by Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, and our friend here at The Takeaway. Dan, this is a well-established trend. Where do we go from here?
I think we're probably going to see more of the same for the next few months. You may remember John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, described the bailout package as a crap sandwich. This report is a crap sandwich of the kind you get at the Carnegie Deli, you know, the really giant ones.
Triple-decker.
I mean, there's no way to sugarcoat anything that's in here. The numbers, 533,000 job loss, revising the numbers down for October, November. So it's basically more than a million jobs, payroll jobs, in the past 3 months. We haven't seen anything like this in, you know, at least 16, 17 years.
And it's impossible at the Carnegie Deli to get your sandwich sugar-coated in any, I mean, they'll take requests, but they won't do that one. Let's talk a little bit about how the employment statistics are a lagging indicator, that basically they're the bad news that follows what's happening in the economy. As far as leading indicators are concerned, what are you seeing there?
Leading indicators aren't looking a whole lot better. I mean, the big things we have to look for, and in a way we have to take some of the kind of models from prior economic cycles and throw them out the window because of the unique nature of what we're seeing, you know, with the housing market having plummeted so much and the way that people's wealth and borrowing is tied up in their houses, you know, that wasn't the case in previous recessions. So I think as far as the indicators, we need to look to housing to stabilize, not to keep going up or to kind of return to that bubble era gains of 10-15% a year, but merely to stabilize, to stop going down. I think that is number one. The jobs, the payroll jobs, again, you know, they say it tends to be a kind of lagging indicator. Companies, they soldier on for several months after things start to go down and then kind of fire people as a last resort, and then they are generally slow to bring people back on because they don't think any recovery is sort of real until that, you know, it sticks for a while. So, you know, the unemployment numbers are important. They're very meaningful, especially to those who are affected, but I don't think that's the number every month to look for to kind of give us a light to the end of this tunnel.
Dan, let's go to your first point, the housing market stabilizing. What is it going to take for that to happen?
Well, number one, a new administration. There have been, you know, quasi-heroic efforts by the Federal Reserve, by Congress and the Treasury to, you know, pump money into the system to try to kind of buck up the mortgage system, get people to lend again. But the real problem is the, on the one hand, oversupply, but underlying this, the inability of a growing number of people to make payments on the mortgages that they have.
Well, and we saw the Treasury stepping in as recently as this week with a program for new home buyers. I wonder how significant that is. And does the efforts that they've already made on the refi market for people who need to stay in their homes, does that amount to more than a tweak at this point?
At this point, it's still a tweak. It's very difficult. You know, Sheila Bair, who's the head of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, for almost a year has been talking about the need for the banking industry to proactively modify mortgages. In other words, if they see someone who's falling behind, don't foreclose on them. That only causes problems for you politically, financially, and causes problems for the customer and the housing market at large, because once you foreclose, the bank just dumps it on the market, and we have huge amounts of inventory. She's been trying to tell the banking system, don't foreclose on people, modify the mortgages, make a deal, you know, accept a lower principal. That's been very difficult to do because so many of these mortgages have been sold to other investors. But in the banks that the FDIC takes over, they're trying to do this more intensively, but you can't, it's tough to do several hundred thousand of those at a time.
No, but that's, let's just stop there for a second. That's a fascinating takeaway. So structurally, it's impossible for banks to refinance mortgages because they don't know where they are anymore. They can't just like go into the back room, pull out the paperwork, call up the borrower and say, all right, we're going to make things better. They have to figure out who in Thailand owns the mortgage, for heaven's sakes.
Well, not only that, we have the situation where the servicer, which is, you know, say the company like Countrywide, which made the loan, then sold it, but it still collects the mortgage payments and then pays the interest payments to the people who bought the bonds based on that mortgage. So the servicer may want to modify the loan.
And that servicer is owned by Bank of America right now.
Right. So they may want to modify the loan, and they're trying to do that, but then you have hedge funds that have bought the bonds that, you know, these mortgages are backed by, saying, wait a minute, you can't modify the loan because we are, you know, the owners of it, and we and these other bondholders, we actually own this mortgage. You can't unilaterally say, by the way, you now have to accept a lower payment because we are modifying the loan, and they're suing. So the innovation and the technology that made this mortgage boom possible, which was securitization, bundling these bonds, selling them to investors, and then they become these things that get traded. That now stands in the way of effective and efficient loan modification.
Dan, that's the first time I've heard that anywhere. I mean, you're basically saying that the boat is sinking and nobody's allowed to bail.
That's part of the problem. If you know, 20 years ago you had made a mortgage to me and I was paying you every month, and then all of a sudden you noticed that I was not paying you anymore, I was having difficulty, you and I would have a meeting and we would make some deal. You know, I pay you what I can, you accept the fact that you're not going to get paid back as much, and, you know, the system processes that and we move on. That type of activity cannot happen effectively in a situation where it sometimes is just impossible to find out or to determine who actually owns the mortgage.
So, Dan, the market can't recover until there is some certainty in an area that you just described that sounds like in my lifetime there will never be any clarity.
Well, if, you know, what is needed is a, we've seen a series of kind of tactical measures, you know, get some liquidity here, buck up this company, announce this sort of lending facility for the Fed. And as I said, as Sheila Bair, who's at the FDIC, has been saying, that's the sort of top-down approach. We need to look at this a little more on a micro level from the bottom up, but look at it at a, you know, at a very large scale. Someone needs to bring into the room the, you know, the industry that securitized these loans, the industry that owns these loans, namely hedge funds, pension funds, investors of different types, the servicers are the people who made the loans and now collect the money. And they have to, you know, bang some heads together and say, this is what's going on. These are the systemic problems we're having now. There has to be some kind of grand bargain here.
Right, and it's a giant meeting, and it probably has to take place on multiple continents. So let's conclude on the issue of what the market seems to be watching over the last couple of days, and that is a wave of bankruptcies that appears to be approaching, particularly in the retail sector, and that the market is beginning to price in employment problems that relate to bankruptcies that we're going to see over the next couple of months.
Well, look, we always have bankruptcies after, you know, the Christmas season, right? There are always a certain number of retailers that were hoping that those 5 weeks, this big shopping period, would save their year. And if it doesn't turn out well for them, they end up filing for bankruptcy in January. That happens every year. I think it's going to happen on a much larger scale this year. We've already seen a bunch of chains, you know, Tweeter, big electronics chain, just, I think, filed for bankruptcy recently. We had Circuit City. This was in the run-up to Christmas. Sears announcing that it was going to close a bunch of stores. So I think there's going to be more, you know, if not kind of outright bankruptcy of whole chains, reductions, you know, big box stores reducing their footprint.
Now, if those stores go under, does that have a ripple effect in the financial sector, and that hedge funds own a lot of junk bonds that are the sort of credit lines for some of these companies?
Yes, but, you know, a lot of the, you know, markets sometimes are efficient in the way they process expectations, so that the, you know, the stocks of a lot of these companies, their bonds are trading at pretty distressed levels already. So,
well, it just goes to show you, 500,000 people lose their jobs. That's some pain. Hedge funds start to default. Nobody cares.
Right.
Dan Gross, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime.
Dan Gross, senior editor of Newsweek, joined us from Westport, Connecticut. I love that guy. It's the first I'd heard about that you can't bail when the boat's sinking in this environment.
Right, that it's the infrastructure is not there.
To even
if they wanted
the
to. Even if they wanted to renegotiate every single one, you can't.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. All week we've been asking the question as to whether or not we've become a nation of part-timers, and Today, we're asking you about what happened when your hours were reduced or you were let go. How did that conversation sound?
I simply said, I can't have you screaming at me like this. And he told me, well, screaming on the top of his lungs, if you can't take my screaming, then this is your last day.
Ouch.
Huh. So that would be an eye-to-eye confrontation. Did you get let go by text? Tell us your worst or your best reduced hours or layoff story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Adore, if you can't take my screaming, this is your last day. My screaming. There are all kinds of football shenanigans going on here in New York. I mean, if you pick up a paper in New York, it's all about Plaxico Burress and how he allegedly entered a club illegally with a gun and shot himself in the thigh. Well, he now faces gun charges, and joining us is Jeff Beresford Howe, the Takeaway's contributor, and our very own one-man tailgate party to discuss the sports stories leading into the weekend. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
I want to tee up all the sports for the weekend, but let's begin with these crazy football characters. I thought NFL football was a team sport.
Well, no, it's a sport of a group of individual contractors being paid by an employer, and each of them looking out for themselves and the employer looking out for themselves.
I mean, in the Plaxico Burress case, I mean, he made a fantastic catch for the Giants that got them, the Super Bowl win, and they certainly got them into the Super Bowl, and then made another catch that was key in the Super Bowl. But it just seems like we're seeing the limits of if you pay people this much, it really encourages dreadful behavior.
Well, you know, people lose track of this. The National Football League is a league composed of young men, mostly in their 20s, who have virtually unlimited amounts of money, women, and alcohol thrown at them. The fact that only about 2.5% of the players get arrested in any one year is kind of miraculous if you think about it that way. I mean, I don't know how you would have reacted in your 20s to that kind of attention, but I can't speak for myself on that one.
Well, I walked around for years with a sandwich board saying, I'm looking for unlimited money, women, and alcohol. Nobody ever really responded to that. How does the Giants respond to keeping their focus? Coughlin, as a coach, has been really good at maintaining the sort of team spirit on the Giants.
Focus is great. Having a really, really good wide receiver is better. I mean, the playoffs are so competitive. At some point, the Giants are going to need a big drive, and Manning's going to be looking around for his go-to receiver, and he's not going to be there. It's going to hurt the Giants in a big way. Whether it keeps them from repeating as Super Bowl champions, you know, that's why they play the games. But it's crazy to think this isn't very damaging to their chances.
You know, the business model in the NBA, speaking of team sports, seems to be damaging to individual players. The Stephon Marbury story with the Knicks, not to focus exclusively on New York with you, but, you know, Stephon Marbury is a great player, has more left in him, but he's sitting on the bench and he refuses to play. What's going on there?
I don't know. The ultimate thing you want to say about Stephon Marbury is that wherever he goes, he has trouble. He never fits in. He's always a hassle. Teams cannot wait to get rid of him once they've got him. He's a bad guy.
But let's take a macro view at this. One of our editors here, Jay, our sports expert, says that really Stephon is an example of what's wrong with the NBA, which is because of how much he's paid, it's almost impossible to trade him.
Well, that's true. Whose fault is that? I mean, he didn't, unlike Plaxico Burress, he didn't walk into the place with a gun and the Knicks voluntarily signed to the contract. I mean,
but now that they're playing,
did he turn down the money?
Well, no, but I think the point is these teams are encouraged now to play these salary cap games, and as a result, the fans get to watch these players sitting on the bench because you know, in the case of the Knicks, they're waiting for LeBron James to be available in 2010, and you know it's going to be sort of a scrub JV basketball until then for the Knicks.
Well, yeah, the Boston Celtics played that game last year, and look where it got them. Yeah, I mean, it's still all about management. Yeah. The problem isn't the salary cap. The problem is bad management.
Well, speaking of bad management, baseball's winter meetings get underway on Monday down in Florida. What sort of management issues are on the table for baseball? They're looking at a recession.
You know, the last time salaries went down was the 1950s. In the adult lifetime of anyone under 66, every year salaries have gone up. That may change this year.
You're kidding.
Based on the early results of arbitration offers, it looks like teams are actually tightening their belts and thinking about getting away from the salary structure that's dominated baseball in the last few years. It's an extraordinary thing.
What other things are going on in the relation between some of these teams and their fans, the pricing models for tickets that relate to the recession and the new realities?
Well, one of the things teams are doing is that they've gone into the business of scalping their own tickets. And the most creative approach to that was announced this week by the San Francisco Giants. Giants had a terrible year last year. They fired Barry Bonds. Their attendance went down by 360,000 people.
Wow.
So the Giants looked around and they said, where can we get some really good advice on providing a better experience for our customers? Hey, I know. Let's ask the airline industry.
Oh, my God.
So what they're going to do this year is they've introduced variable pricing on their seats. They're using this statistical algorithm they got from these two Yahoos in Texas. And they've set aside some seats, and they're going to charge fans different prices for those same seats depending on demand as the game approaches.
So same-day purchase, like same-day flight ticket purchase, is going to cost you more than if you get, you know, 2 week advance.
The Giants insisted it also could cost you less, and it's possible, I suppose, that that's true, depending on what kind of floor they put on prices. The airlines will not sell you a seat for $50 on the last day.
That's great. And if you stay over on a Saturday, you get a discount, too. That's Dylan, our director, suggested.
I know.
And who would want to see the Giants anyway?
Well, right. What it means is that you get that great experience common to all travelers. You're sitting there watching the game. You're going to ask the guy next to you how much you paid for a ticket, and he's going to say $15, and you just paid $75, and you're going to feel like a chump.
You're just going to have to eat your hot dog and enjoy the game. Jeff Beresford Howe joined us from Oakland, California, our one-man tailgate party sports for the weekend. Thanks, Jeff. And now Femi, okay, has some headlines.
Thank you very much. 29 minutes past the hour. A new economic report this morning. The Labor Department's reporting that the jobless rate for November rose to 6.7%. That means more than 500,000 Americans lost their jobs last month. CEOs from the Big Three are on the Hill again today, arguing for their multi-billion dollar bailout, and they'll be in front of the House this time. And Japanese car makers are dealing with the tough economic situation as well. Honda is pulling out of Formula One racing. The sales were down of Hondas by more than 40% last month, and the Honda Formula One team cost about $500 million to run.
Sport of kings there. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Unemployment numbers released this morning show a national rate of 6.7%. That brings the number of people who have lost their jobs to 1.9 million this year alone. So there were many conversations like this.
This is Tammy Bjorklund in Grand Forks, North Dakota. I was an instructor at a major university here. I went in on Monday morning, came in, I sat down. He told me, we're letting you go early. I said, this is very unfair. He said, oh, well, I sympathize with you.
So how did that go for you when they reduced your hours or perhaps laid you off? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And Wall Street has just opened, and reacting to the unemployment news, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 1%, and the S&P about the same. So as the new president-elect is transitioning into office, our current commander-in-chief, you may have noticed, President Bush, is thinking back on his two terms, the good times and the bad times.
Greatest disappointment.
Well, I mentioned one, and that is no weapons of mass destruction. I think another in Iraq, I think another great disappointment was not getting immigration reform done. I firmly believe that the immigration debate really didn't show the true nature of America as a welcoming society.
One disappointment of President George W. Bush, talking with Charles Gibson in an interview on December 2nd on ABC News. Joining us now is Roberto Lovato, a contributor to our partner New American Media and author of the blog Of America. Roberto, he's not the only one who's disappointed by the lack of immigration reform during the Bush administration. Right, Roberto?
Glad to be here.
You are, first of all, disappointed that there hasn't been any immigration reform in the last two terms, but you're also worried about the early signs from the Obama administration. Describe to me what you're concerned about.
Well, just a note on Mr. Bush's disappointment about immigration reform. He should have said that he's disappointed that he left thousands of dead people in the desert, he's disappointed that there were thousands of raids terrorizing immigrants in their homes, and that he's been at the head of a failed immigration bureaucracy that is, you know, literally killing people. And so my great hope is that the Obama administration would turn the tortilla on this, as we say, as far as really humanizing, first and foremost, the immigration process, which has become kind of the domestic equivalent of Guantanamo, if you look at like our detention centers for immigrants.
Well, does the appointment of Janet Napolitano as the head of Homeland Security, who has her own record on immigration in Arizona, the state where she comes from, does that make you feel good or worried?
Well, most of those people that died in the deserts that I mentioned in talking about Bush's weapons of mass immigration destruction were in Arizona.
Do you put them at the foot of Janet Napolitano?
They died at the foot of Janet Napolitano's border, where she wanted to put – well, she actually was the one of the first governors to call for deploying the National Guard to protect us against the threat of gardeners and maids and other immigrants wanting to come into the United States. She's also been a very strong but tacit supporter of a guy named Joe Arpaio, who's soon to be a Fox movie star if rumors are correct. And Joe Arpaio is a sheriff, a very controversial, even nefarious sheriff, who is responsible for people dying in detention, immigrants dying and non-immigrants dying in detention, conducting sweeps of entire Latino neighborhoods, which is, you know, a lot of the part of Arizona near in Phoenix where he's at. And so,
all right, but he's not in the Obama administration. Just to be clear, right. You are looking at a hardline policy in the early going out of Barack Obama on immigration, and that concerns you.
It's not just me. It's the more than almost 15% of the electorate that's Latino that, you know, voted for him based on some promises that he himself made. So, they've created expectations that they will in fact turn their tortilla over on immigration reform by revamping immigration. I mean, a lot of us are hoping, for example, that rather than put our immigration bureaucracy in the kind of anti-terrorist bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security, that he would go back to the history of contemporary and modern immigration policy, which has been to put it in the Department of Labor, Commerce,
and then
even
he could
the
do
Treasury.
Without Congress. He could do that without Congress.
He could do this very easily, as Mr. Bush reorganized our entire government and in the process our entire way of life. That he's now kind of lamenting.
So do you think the rollbacks of current immigration policy are absolutely in order, or is there some sort of incremental change that you would support?
Given the people dying in the desert, given people dying in detention, given the fact that you have a massive underclass of millions of people are being exploited at work, exploited in their crowded apartment buildings, exploited in the radio and then the media sphere by, you know.
Okay, no, you said that, but let's talk policy then. So you would support an amnesty, a broad amnesty for undocumented workers in the United States now, and more resources towards getting people proper visas?
Yeah, I'm not real keen on the amnesty language because that's kind of like the right wing has really demonized the process of legalizing people who've been here, like my cousins, for, in some cases, decades without any legal status and have been working, paying taxes, and contributing to the larger society. We're in difficult economic times, and we have to be realistic. And I think what the Obama administration will do will be piecemeal. It won't be an initial grand package, although Harry Reid has been signaling lately that, in fact, they want a whole comprehensive immigration reform. And so I hope the
new Congress will be definitely taking a look at that next year. And the question is, will these expectations that you say Barack Obama has raised in your community, will they be met or will they be dashed? Roberto Lovato, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Roberto Lovato is a contributor to our partner, New America Media, and author of the blog Of America. And now we have headlines from Femi. Okay.
Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. GM has just announced that they will be laying off 2,000 factory workers early next year. General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner is testifying before Congress today with the other members of the Big Three. And those workers aren't alone. A new report from the Labor Department says that more than 500,000 Americans lost their jobs last month, and that means the jobless rate for November rose to 6.7%. Some major world leaders are calling for Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe to step down. Kenya's Prime Minister Raila Odinga said yesterday that African governments should oust the leader. Nobel Prize winner Desmond Tutu is calling for his resignation as well. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says, and I'm going to quote her here, "It's well past time," end of quote, for him to leave. NASA's next mission to Mars is on hold. They've delayed the launch of a massive robot until 2011. They've cited several problems, which include sticking brakes when it gets cold. The project's also had some cost issues, and this delay will boost its price to nearly $2.3 billion. And once finally on Mars, the spacecraft will study its climate and geology in greater detail than previous missions. And that's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And joining us now is BBC correspondent Sanjoy Manjumdar from Delhi in India. Welcome, Sanjoy.
Hello.
So tell us about the deal that was signed today or agreed to today between India and Russia.
Well, Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev is in Delhi for a three-day visit. And this morning he signed an agreement with the Indian government, effectively under which Russia will build for India four nuclear reactors. Now, these are power reactors. These are going to be built in the south of India, where Russia had already built a reactor several decades ago. And this has all been made possible following the agreement that was signed between India and the United States earlier this year, which was a civilian nuclear agreement under which India, which is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, is allowed to get access to nuclear technology and fuel. So it's a one-time exception has been made for India. And this has been ratified by the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which is a group of about 45 countries around the world which trade in nuclear technology. And a ban which was in place for India since it hadn't signed the NPT was lifted earlier this year.
And Sanjoy, is there any significance at all to the timing?
No, in the sense that I think an agreement was on the cards. It's the important thing is this is the first major agreement signed by India for nuclear commerce, if you like, since the agreement with Washington. Now, that agreement, of course, was finally sealed towards the very end of the George W. Bush tenure. It was almost one of the very last pieces of legislation that his administration saw through. And this is the first major agreement under that, under that deal. Besides that, no major significance in terms of timing. The Russian president was on a scheduled visit, and this was on top of his agenda.
And how important is this to India, clearly a country that has been growing rapidly in recent years?
Well, that's exactly the point. India has been growing rapidly in recent years. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And the problem it's facing is that its infrastructure just hasn't been able to keep pace with its economic growth. And one of the key areas where it's very, very weak is power generation. India simply doesn't have enough power to feed its numerous industries. It's not unusual, for instance, for factories in many parts of India to have to make do with 12 to 15 hour power cuts, because of which they have to invest in diesel generators. So India is looking desperately for access to new technologies to generate power, and also clean technologies, because of course traditional thermal power stations are very polluting. Diesel generators are very polluting.
But what's the timeline on these, quickly, Sanjoy?
Well, it's going to take several years, because clearly, you know, they have to begin building it. There's a blueprint which has to be made. These aren't exactly going to be sort of cast and shipped across from Russia. So it's going to be several years before they're up and running.
Sanjoy Manjumdar, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Sanjoy is a Delhi-based BBC correspondent.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Time for headlines from Femi Okay.
Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The Big Three automaker chiefs are now on the Hill. House lawmakers are taking their chances at grilling them today. The CEOs are defending their proposals for tens of billions in taxpayer-funded loans. They say they can turn their companies around if they get a bundle of money. Lawmakers have been sceptical so far. The leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan meet today. They're talking about ways to stabilize the lawless regions around their border. Militants are known to launch attacks from the Pakistani side. Millions of Muslims are making their way to Mecca. Tomorrow is the beginning of the Hajj pilgrimage, and the economic crisis in the U.S. is having an impact. Many American Muslims are postponing the long trip to the Middle East to save money. And finally, opening in the theatres today, the docudrama Frost Nixon, based on the 1977 interview with David Frost and Richard Nixon. And if you head to the cinema today, it'll be one of the ways the economy is doing well. Cinemas are seeing their box office receipts boosted by about double in the last quarter. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi. We're going to turn now to the BBC's World Updates presenter, Dan Damon, who has been presenting his show from Baghdad since Tuesday. On his last day in Iraq, he joined us from there earlier with what it's like to patrol with the U.S. military and sum up his experience.
It's a new Iraq, there's no question about that. There are some of the old things coming back. I'll talk about those in a moment. But the security is obviously much better for Americans. At the moment, because of the politics, because there are elections coming, it's very dangerous to be a part of the political system rebuilding Iraq. I was taken by one of the army units I went out with to an investigation of an assassination. That was yet another official. 50 people died in Baghdad until yesterday. I guess the numbers have gone up. And the reason is that they are trying to take part. They're joining police units, military units, or they're in ministries and they become targets. It's a really locked down city, and that's a change I've noticed. I was last here during the handover from Americans to the Iraqis in 2004. There's a lot more security here now. Still dangerous, though.
Oh, that's interesting. Dan, is that a sound effects reel, or is that a real rooster wandering around behind you?
That is a real rooster. getting food's a problem sometimes, so people keep what they can in their backyards.
So you just mentioned the patrols that you went on. You want to describe the group that you were with and what their mission was?
Their mission was to help build what's called a JSS, a joint security station with the Iraqi army and police. They were out in one of what was the dangerous areas of Baghdad, a majority Sunni, so therefore mostly opposed to the American invasion. This is Mansour, and they were part of a base that was built more or less overnight. The way they do this is in a high insurgency area. They go out with armored trucks at dusk. They throw up the concrete elements of watchtowers, of blast walls, and when the dawn comes up, the insurgents see that there's a base there, a pretty hard one to hit, and that immediately begins to give the local people a sense of security that the Americans aren't commuting to the battle, as it's called, that they're going to be there with them, and they'll help them face down the militants, the hard guys. And that happened a few months ago. This unit that I was with, which was B Battery of the 42nd Field Artillery of the 4th Infantry Division, they were out there working to boost the Iraqi police and the army. And I went out with them on a night patrol, a joint patrol with the Iraqi police. And my guide was Lieutenant John Folk. And as we walked on foot behind the Humvees that were still there with the gunners in their turrets cautiously swinging around, watching to see what was happening, the soldiers with their torches on their rifles, their flashlights, looking down every alley, looking for explosive devices, I asked John Folk, why was the surge needed?
Well, they needed a surge because the number of activities going on, as you look, you can't see from one street to the next, so... you put more troops on the ground, and that allows more ground coverage. So in their eyes, they run the risk of getting searched by twice as many times because you have twice as many troops, twice as many platoons out conducting operations.
I should tell you about the reaction of the people as we walked along, because this was what I was really interested to see. I wouldn't say that it was friendly, but it was polite. They have a program, these U.S. troops. I don't know if they were joshing me. They said it was actually a real program with a name called Beanies for Baghdad. But anyway, what they were doing was handing out Beanie Babies to kids as they were walking along. They stopped at market stalls deliberately, bought food from the stall holders there. They were just trying to mix in. Now, if you're walking along in body armor with a Kevlar helmet on, I guess it's difficult to just behave like one of the crowd, but they were at least conversational. They were in and amongst the community, and I think that is why the surge has had the effect that it's had in places like Mansour, which are much, much calmer. But there is still a great deal of danger because, as I said, we were on foot patrol. We were then told to mount up because they were sent to investigate an assassination of a Ministry of Defense official, and when we got onto that scene, it was really horrible. The bomb had been stuck, I guess magnetic bomb, sticky bomb they call them, underneath the driver's pan in the car, and really there was nothing of the driver's compartment left. A great deal of blood around, as you can imagine. This guy just driven his wife to hospital and then come away on his way home to see his kids. I mean, you can imagine how horrible all of that is. So there's plenty of that kind of violence around. So I asked Lieutenant Folk, as they move through the streets then, how careful are they? How worried are they that every trash bag, every hole in the road is not going to be a bomb aimed at them?
Right.
There's actually a great deal of work going on in all the mahalas surrounding the JSS as far as houses being renovated. People are feeling a lot safer. They're moving back into the area that were originally pushed out.
Well, that's interesting. Dan, you know, in your view of Baghdad, where does the green zone sit? Is it this forbidding kind of temple in the center of town? Does it interact at all with the rest of the city? How do people view it as you walk around on these patrols in the place where real Baghdadis live?
Well, they view it as a traffic problem, I'm afraid, John. Right. That's a fact. It does. Indeed, there is a plan to remove the green zone in a few months' time, or at least open up part of it anyway, and everybody's looking forward to that because it means that there'll be a much easier way of moving around the city. Talking about temples, this morning I was at the Al Faw Palace, one of Saddam's many marbled palaces, and excuse me, this may warm your heart a bit, because outside this palace, which is now part of the U.S. military complex, they were setting up for a live WWE wrestling show entertaining the troops, U.S. and Iraqi troops, standing around in huge numbers, massive stars and stripes, lots of lights, lots of color, patriotic songs outside Saddam's palace. So I guess that proves a big point.
Dan, the Iraqi parliament and government have approved the status of forces agreement, which ostensibly sets a timetable for U.S. forces to withdraw. Do people on the streets now view that their government is legitimate because of this, or is it just of no importance to them?
It depends where you go, but yes, people do generally think that the government is legitimate. There are groups, of course, which don't. There's a whole range of different violent groups here. There are the ideological extremists, Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda inspired, who are hoping for an Islamic caliphate. Not very many of them, but they do manage to recruit, especially amongst young men, and indeed some foreign fighters are still coming over the border. One of the concerns is that the Syrian border will be difficult to patrol when the Americans pull back. There are those groups that are simply struggling for power. One interesting point is that Muqtada al-Sadr, a name you've probably heard plenty of the past few years, he's now in Tehran more or less most of the time, or in Iran, and there is a sign that when the elections come, he will lose his grip on those very many poor Shiites who did think that he was some kind of salvation. They really haven't achieved much. He hasn't achieved much for them, and there's a possibility that a more engaged, a more responsible Shiite leadership for the lower classes, that that will emerge from this political process. Right. So that is a positive thing to hope for.
Dan Damon, presenter of the BBC's World Update.
A World Update from Iraq all week. That's fascinating stuff. Anyway, are we becoming a nation of part-timers over here in the U.S. of A? All week we've been looking at the changing labor force. If you were let go, what was that like to be told that you were going to be let go? Here's how Toby's friend was let go.
She checked her email and had been told from her company that she would no longer be employed, that they've been downsized. Couldn't believe that they would do that to her via email. Completely insensitive. Where has humanity gone?
If it's too painful to talk about how you got laid off, just have one of your friends call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
You may remember John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, described the bailout package as a crap sandwich. This report is a crap sandwich of the kind you get at the Carnegie Deli, you know, the really giant ones.
That's Dan Gross, senior editor of Newsweek, talking about the unemployment numbers that were released today.
6.7%, worse since 1974. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know what I went through? Knowing I was going to have to fire my mentor? Carrying that around in my head for a week? Could you get...